From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Picky, Picky, Picky. When Edwin Newman speaks, invariably it's a critique of the gassy, ghastly oratory he finds all throughout our culture. But whenever he stumbles, the switchboard explodes. Also today, I speak with horror writer Patrick McGrath, who one critic called a Poe for the 80s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of two works by contemporary composer Lou Harrison. And our own language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the dictionary and the malaprop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. On October 10th, 1973, in a nationally broadcast address, Vice President Spiro Agnew called network news correspondents nattering nabobs of negativism. Edwin Newman was anchoring the address for NBC TV. He got word from the top level to dispense with the customary summary and analysis Agnew objected to and get off as quickly as possible after the address. He did, but the following year, on page 2 of Newman's best-selling book Strictly Speaking, Newman used Agnew's alliteration as an example of what serious trouble our language is in. Edwin Newman is well known to most Americans, both for his television work and for his attempts to defend the English language against pomposity, banality, and other abuses. Newman spent most of his career at NBC, where he worked as a correspondent, commentator, and host. Since retiring in 1984, he's written a syndicated column. His columns on English, the news, and other matters are collected in a new book called I Must Say. Newman told me that his interest in language was encouraged when he was young.
A teacher told me, in fact, it was in junior high school, that I wrote well, and I believed her, which had a considerable effect on my life.
Were you already, when you were young, interested in uses and abuses of the English language, and did you ever correct friends who misspoke?
Yes, I did, not always to the general delight of those I corrected, I must say. I also had to be careful at home about correcting anybody. For one thing, my parents did not have anything like the advantages that I did. Neither of them so much as graduated from high school. So it was necessary to be sensible about it, not to be overbearing about it, which I think is good advice for anyone, even today.
When did you start thinking in terms of becoming a journalist?
I thought about that certainly as early as when I was in high school, because I worked on the high school paper at George Washington High School in New York. The paper was called The Cherry Tree.
Oh, gosh. Now, how did they come up with that title?
Can't imagine. And I certainly was doing it then. And, in fact, my brother and I both were fond of the idea of becoming newspaper men, which was what you thought about in those days, not radio, not television. And, in fact, we both did. Quite how that happened, I don't know, because the business that my father was in was very far indeed from newspaper work. He was in men's clothing for the most part, and then various others, but never anything to do with journalism, and there wasn't anybody in our family who'd had anything to do with journalism. But it was a romantic notion, I think, probably brought on to some extent by the books we read, many of them borrowed from the public library.
Now, I think your very first job in journalism was with the International News Service.
Yes.
As a dictation writer.
But you make it sound more dignified than it was. The job was called dictation boy. Now, of course, obviously, there were no girls doing the job at that time. We're talking about 1941.
So what was the job exactly?
I began as a dictation boy on the Hill, Capitol Hill in Washington, on the Senate side, reading over the phone, dictating over the phone, stories written by INS reporters on the Hill. And I would, INS didn't have as many reporters as its rivals, United Press and the Associated Press, and they couldn't take the time always to read their own stories, dictate their own stories, so they would hand them to me or the dictation boy on the Hill, who would then read them over the telephone to a dictation boy at a typewriter in the office. So I was a dictation boy who dictated stories at first, and then after a while I was moved into the office because I could type fast, I really could, and became a dictation boy at that end, which meant that you sat there typing what reporters and dictation boys on the Hill dictated to you, and there was a system by which you could, it was on the floor, as I recall, you pushed a button with your foot, clicked, that meant, that told the person dictating that, yes, you were ready to take the next phrase or the next sentence, whatever it happened to be.
Well, what happened was, what was supposed to happen, you rose, became a reporter, wrote from the States and from abroad, and eventually you moved to CBS and worked with Eric Severide. I think you wrote copy for him.
I did. He had a daily program.
This was on radio.
On radio. It was on Monday through Friday, I should say. It was 15 minutes long, which was a lot of copy. There was no use of, virtually no use of, taped reports from anybody else in those days. And the commercials were also very short. They would now be considered extraordinarily short. So there was a great deal of writing to be done. You might have to write 13 or 14 minutes of copy on a 15-minute show, and obviously anybody would need help doing that, particularly with the stories breaking and changing as the day went along.
What were some of the first things that you learned about the difference between writing for newspapers and writing for the radio?
Well, one thing I learned very quickly, and I had a very good teacher, was that wire service jargon was something that had to be left out. There are certain terms that we use in newspaper wire service writing. Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega said today, you really shouldn't be saying that kind of thing on the air. I remember I had written something, and it was looked at by another celebrated CBS name, you may recall, Winston Burdett. I had used the word gird. Somebody was girding, G-I-R-D-I-N-G, for a struggle in the Congress. And Winston said to me, we don't use that word here. You don't use words that are difficult to take in, and you should stay away from words that are cliches, that simply go unheard by the public because they've been used so often. And, of course, you do your best to stay away from complicated constructions. You have to learn those things quickly, but if you're lucky enough to have somebody around who cares and who understands and is prepared to put in a little time with you, you can learn that kind of thing quickly.
Edwin Newman is my guest, and he has a new collection of syndicated columns, a new collection of his columns. It's called I Must Say. Now, how did you get from radio into TV? You were with NBC Radio and TV for about 34 years.
Well, 1949, my wife and daughter and I left Washington, went, so we believed, to Paris, where I was expecting to go to work for UNESCO. And in fact, I did go to work for UNESCO, but literally for a day or two, because an offer came in from NBC. We had stopped off in London, and I'd gone to the NBC office at someone's suggestion. An offer came in to become the stringer in London for NBC. Perhaps I should explain that term. I don't mean to you, but there may be people in the audience who don't know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
A stringer is somebody who's not on the staff, who is paid for the work he or she does. Now, typically in newspaper work, stringers are paid by the inch, the inches that are actually printed. And when you're a broadcast stringer, you're paid for the broadcast you do. So you're not on the staff, and you don't have any guaranteed income, but you're called on from time to time. And that's how I began with NBC. Well, in those days, of course, it was radio. Television was beginning, and even while I was stringing for NBC, I began to do television. For example, I was asked to go to Morocco, what was then French Morocco in North Africa, to do some stories for television about our air bases there. And gradually, as television became more important than radio did, one moved into television. I did. I enjoyed it. I liked doing it. I have a sufficient degree of hamminess, perhaps, to enjoy being on camera. And it helps if you are that way. If you're terribly nervous before a camera, it can be agonizing. And indeed, there are people in the business who are that way. They never quite get over their nervousness. That was not a problem I had. I enjoyed television.
What was your reaction the first time you saw yourself on TV?
I was very pleased. Perhaps I shouldn't admit that, but I was pleased, and I thought, well, this is something I can do.
You were on television during several key historical moments. I think didn't you have to anchor the special bulletins or the continuing coverage after the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy?
Yes, I did. I became the person at NBC for many years who dealt with emergencies, was called in when something usually dreadful of that kind had happened. And I began with the shooting of President Kennedy. I announced President Kennedy's death, but on the radio, and then went to Washington and did both radio and television. But when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, yes, it seemed to me I was on the air for days. The same was true with Robert Kennedy, and then I did that again with George Wallace, did it again with the shooting of Ronald Reagan.
Let me ask you about the first time when you had to announce John Kennedy's assassination on the radio. When you're dealing with something tragic like that and you have to announce it, there are two considerations in how you're going to speak. One is basically uncontrollable. I mean, how do you feel and how is that going to, in spite of yourself, get expressed in your voice? And the other is, what kind of tone do you consciously want to strive for in your announcement of this terrible event? What tone of voice did you use when you announced Kennedy's assassination?
I have heard myself. I've heard recordings of myself announcing the president's death. In fact, heard one last night, no longer ago than that. And obviously, my voice was grave and it was somber. And it was not necessary to put that on. That's how you felt. In fact, as you sat there dealing with this information, you couldn't help asking yourself, is this really happening? Then, because you are in the news business, you say to yourself, in effect, well, if this is really happening, I'm glad I'm the one they've chosen to deal with it, because in a way, it's a mark of confidence, but also because you understand that you have to bring a certain degree of detachment to it. Now, not everybody can do that, and if not everybody can do that, that's easily understandable. Some people are more affected than others. But clearly, if you're a human being, you're going to be affected by it, and that will show in your voice. It seems to me you do not try for it.
Well, when you're anchoring after a tragedy like an assassination, there's a lot of improvising you have to do. There's a certain amount of copy you'll be handed, but in an extended report, you have to talk about things as they're happening, and you also have to fill time a lot as the news is developing. I think it's a very difficult thing to do, and a place where it's really easy to embarrass yourself if you say the wrong thing.
Yes, I quite agree that I agree on all the points you've just mentioned. Now, when you are on the air, especially early after an event of this kind, when the story is breaking, you tend to be on the air alone. There may not be any organization in place. It takes time to get producers and takes time to get other people on the air and get the whole thing organized, and you may find yourself doing it pretty much alone, which happened to me more than once. And then when you are ad-libbing, what you find is that it is tremendously useful to have a considerable range of knowledge. Now, it may be miscellaneous knowledge that you have never brought into play before, but the more you know, the easier it is to ad-lib. And to give you an example, when the train carrying the body of Robert Kennedy was being taken from New York to Washington, it left Pennsylvania Station here in New York. The trip was to take 4 hours. It actually took 8 hours. I was on the air alone, and it took some time for it to be understood that this was going to go on for a lot longer than 4 hours, and NBC began wheeling in other people finally to give me a hand. But I knew, for example, as a result of having worked in Rome, that Pennsylvania Station had been modeled on a celebrated structure in Rome, the Baths of Caracalla. So you talk about that. Now, I don't mean that you waste time, but sometimes you do have to fill time.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the news, but I also want to talk with you about another subject of yours, language. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Edwin Newman, and he worked with NBC for around 34 years. A collection of his syndicated newspaper columns has just been published. It's called I Must Say. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Edwin Newman is my guest. Now, you've written several best-selling books about our language. And I'd like to know how language and protecting the language became a serious interest of yours.
It had been a serious interest of mine for a very long time as someone in the news business, because, after all, language is the instrument with which we work. Well, language and pictures, but certainly when I began, more language than pictures. And I thought that it was the business of anybody in the news business to, it was the part of anybody in the news business to examine what he was told or what she was told. And you cannot do that. You cannot examine what you're being told and judge its veracity unless you understand language, and not particularly unless you understand when language is being used in an attempt to mislead you, which can happen. Certainly can happen to people in the business. So if you are in the news business, you have an obligation, it seems to me, to understand the language and to protect it. I took that very seriously. Then time came when I became somewhat well known on television, and publishers approached me about writing a book. And finally, when I decided to see whether I could write a book, that was a subject that I thought I had something to say about that had perhaps not been said before, or at any rate had not been said recently.
Now, I've read that you used to keep files of bad writing that you'd come across at work. is that right?
It is true. When I decided on this book, my editor, a woman named Jeanette Hopkins, said to me, "Just collect some envelopes, mark one with the name of a particular subject, sports, let's say, another one news, another one government language, and so on and so on, and collect clippings." I was amazed at how quickly the clippings piled up.
Did you keep these files hidden from your colleagues? I'd hate to think what would happen if one of your colleagues found their copy in your file.
I kept the files at home, but I did a lot of work on the book in the office, did a lot of writing in the office. But I was tactful. Tactful and careful about what I did.
Were you ever caught?
Yes, people used to kid me a great deal and tell me they didn't want to say anything in my presence, and they were very careful about what they were writing because they didn't want to wind up in one of my books or perhaps in one of the essays I was doing on the air. I did a number of essays on the air on the subject before even the first book came out, and I had written a good many articles, magazine articles, The Atlantic, Harper's, New York Times Magazine, and some others, on this subject, so that even before the books came out, people knew of my interest.
If you see yourself as a protector of the English language, who are you protecting it from?
I am protecting it in the first place from people who are addicted to mushy language, to smog, the dull language, the pompous, boneless, gassy language, I am doing my best to protect it against those people in the first place. In the second place, I'm trying to protect it from people who think it doesn't matter how you speak, how you express yourself, how you write, that what matters is that your heart be in the right place. I think it does matter. I think one reason we have seen much increased understanding of the importance of language in this country recently, as I say, one reason is that we have begun to see that the industrial challenge from other countries requires us to be efficient. So if you're going to be efficient, you must use the language efficiently. You must use the language productively. You must not waste time. You must not obscure meanings. You should make them clear. For all of these reasons, I thought it was a subject of prime importance to the country.
You've said that Watergate revealed the sad state of our language. What about the Iran-Contra scandal?
I think the Iran-Contra scandal, in a way, repeated what we saw happening in over Vietnam and over Watergate, that a good deal of language was being used to deceive. People were using it to deceive other people, and to some extent they were using it to deceive themselves. There was a vast amount of deception and self-deception that went on during the Iran-Contra affair, and nothing helps the cause of deception or self-deception so much as what I've been calling pompous language, boneless language, language that is not concrete and specific. Now, I cite it. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
This was not Iran-Contra. This was the invasion of Grenada. And one of those in command, an admiral who was in command, explained, he said this, he explained why we didn't know more about Grenada. He said, "We were not micromanaging Grenada intelligence-wise until about that time frame." Now, when you begin to use terms like micromanaging, you have an implication that you know everything there is to know about a place or about a subject. Micromanaging Grenada intelligence-wise, why not say we didn't begin collecting information? That's really what it's about. And I think that this kind of thing, as I say, tends to puff up people about what they're doing. It tends to make what they're doing sound somehow abstruse, difficult to understand, something special.
Let me ask you this. You have done many, many broadcast interviews. Many of those interviews have been with government officials, and many government officials are guilty of the crimes you've just cited, using language for, you know, self-importantly, and puffing up things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever confront anyone on the air if they were using language in such a way as to totally confuse the issue?
Yes, I have. I would say, what do you mean by that? Or I might say, if I were in a sufficiently foul mood, what you have in mind is, is such and such and such and such. Yes, you do. You may do that, but you don't want to be offensive doing that kind of thing, and you certainly don't want to insult anybody, so you try to do it tactfully. On the other hand, when people do come in to be interviewed by me, they generally know what my attitude is, and they tend to watch themselves and not use phrases of the kind I have just been setting out. But I don't want to give you the impression that this is confined to government. It's not confined to government at all. It's in the academic world, it's in the business world. In the business world, for example, the term disagreement is in the process in some areas of being replaced by non-concurrence, which softens it.
Have you ever been on TV and had to read someone else's copy and in the middle of reading it live on the air realize that it was badly written or there was one of those words that you especially hate in it?
Yes.
Or sentence was badly constructed. What did you do?
Yes, but that would have happened only if the copy had been placed in front of me and I had not seen it before going on the air.
But I'm sure that's happened.
But it certainly has happened, and as you know, when you're broadcasting, there is a technique which is you're reading ahead. You're trying to stay a phrase or two ahead of what you're actually saying. Now, if you're able to do that, you can sometimes come up with a substitute in time. But sometimes you just have to swallow and hope for the best. And incidentally, when I made a mistake on the air, because of my reputation, people all over the country would telephone NBC. NBC switchboards would light up all over the country, which was rather flattering and encouraging, really. And sometimes we'd get, if I made a mistake, we would get so much mail that we had to work up a form reply. So I was very conscious of the burden that I had brought up, placed on myself.
On TV, of course, you have to prevent a stricken look from crossing your face.
Yes, you do.
If you're reading copy and you realize that there's...
Radio, you get away with it, but on television, you must not look stricken, I agree.
Are you ever sorry that you've become an example of what good speech is supposed to be like? I'm thinking, you know, if you're talking casually, extemporaneously, either in person or on the air, and you get something wrong, if you make a grammatical mistake or one of those little phrases like, you know, should accidentally pop into what you're saying, you've criticized so many people for it that people would be really just so ready to
yes.
criticize you if you made a mistake.
Yes, I do have to be careful, but I have found over the years that it truly isn't very difficult. It's as easy to speak grammatically as it is to speak ungrammatically, and in fact, it's easier to speak grammatically once you've had the necessary education, done the required reading, and once you've done enough thinking on the subject. So it isn't a terrible burden. I kid myself about it and tell other people that I have placed a great burden on myself, but when they tell me they're afraid to say anything in my presence, and I say, think how I feel. But in fact, it honestly isn't that difficult. And this is a fundamental point, if there's still time to say so. People should not be led to believe that it is difficult to speak correctly, that it is terribly difficult to use the language correctly. It isn't. In fact, once you know how to use it correctly, using it correctly is easier than using it incorrectly.
But do you want people to feel intimidated when they speak?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. My guest has been Edwin Newman, who had been an NBC newscaster for about 35 years, and he has written several books on language. His new book is a collection of his syndicated newspaper columns. The book is called I Must Say, Edwin Newman on English, the News, and Other Matters. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll feature a concert with jazz clarinetist Kenny DeVern, and he'll be playing jazz standards and some swing tunes. He'll be joined by Phil Flanagan on bass, Howard Alden on guitar. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Patrick McGrath grew up on the grounds of an asylum for the criminally insane. Now he writes horror stories. Coming up, Patrick McGrath talks about updating the Gothic horror tale. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two works by contemporary composer Lou Harrison. The 71-year-old composer has also been a dancer, a dance critic, and a poet. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses how we use dictionaries. He says dictionary definitions are often given out of context, which can result in strange and funny malaprops. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The White House said today that President Reagan will pocket veto a bill designed to impose stricter ethical standards on lobbying by former federal employees. Mr. Reagan said that the legislation had been cobbled together by Congress, and he said the bill treats the executive branch far more harshly than former members of Congress and their senior staffs. President-elect George Bush filled the second of two top White House advisory posts today. He named retired Air Force General Brent Scowcroft as his national security advisor. Scowcroft also held that position in the Ford administration, and he worked with Bush, who was CIA director at the time. Details from NPR's Jim Angle.
Bush said Scowcroft is the model of what an NSC advisor should be. The vice president said he will be an honest broker who will convey exactly the feelings of the cabinet members involved in national security and international affairs, but also will bring something more.
Because of his tremendous experience, obviously, he will convey to me, unvarnished, his own view on policy matters of tremendous importance. So I see it as in the Scowcroft NSC leadership will be modeled after the Scowcroft NSC leadership.
Scowcroft is a retired Air Force general with a Ph.D. in international affairs. He is widely respected as an intelligent and quiet analyst who is comfortable out of the limelight, a key qualification for national security advisor. He served on two important commissions during the Reagan administration, one that analyzed policy options for strategic nuclear forces, the other, the Tower Commission, which studied what went wrong in the NSC that allowed the Iran-Contra scandal to happen. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
New Hampshire Governor John Sununu, President-elect Bush's designated chief of staff, met with Jewish leaders today. Sununu reassured the group that he sympathizes with their interests. A spokesman for the group said it was a good meeting. The Jewish community expressed some concern over Sununu's appointment because of the governor's failure to sign a resolution condemning a UN resolution that equated Zionism with racism. Sununu was the only governor in the nation not to sign the resolution because he said it was wrong for a governor to make pronouncements on foreign policy. A spokesman for the group today said Sununu's views at the meeting were well received. According to the PLO Observer mission to the United Nations, Yasser Arafat will arrive in New York on December 1st to address the UN General Assembly. It would be Arafat's first visit to the U.S. since 1974 and follows the Palestine National Council's declaration of an independent Palestinian state. But NPR's Anne Garrels reports that the trip is far from guaranteed.
Yasser Arafat doesn't have a U.S. visa. The United Nations has informed the U.S. mission that Arafat wants to visit the General Assembly. Typically, this would trigger the State Department to issue a visa. But in this case, the State Department is sticking to the rule book, insisting that Arafat fill out a visa application. And that, said one official, has not been done. Nor has the administration decided how to respond if Arafat does in fact make a formal application. The administration is now debating whether an Arafat trip now would encourage PLO moderation or do the opposite, whether the trip would enhance the peace process or complicate it. The administration is also debating whether it's legally bound to give Arafat a visa under the UN headquarters agreement. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A new study on smoking published in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine says that people are basically never too old to quit. Researchers at the University of Washington and the Mayo Clinic found that even people in their 70s significantly reduce the risk of heart attack and death if they can kick the habit. IBP Incorporated today agreed to pay a reduced fine of $975,000 to settle government charges of safety violations at its Dakota City, Nebraska packing house. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial Average rose more than 14 points. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Lou Harrison is a West Coast composer whose music hasn't been played very much on the East Coast. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of two Harrison compositions, music that is a blend of Eastern and Western influences.
Lou Harrison's 71 years have been nothing if not eventful and varied. He's written plays, poetry, and dance criticism. He's been a dancer, a devotee of Esperanto, and a noted calligrapher. In 1947, he became the first conductor to lead a complete Ives symphony. In the mid-1930s, he was a student of composer Henry Cowell in San Francisco, along with John Cage. With Cage, Harrison claims to have formed the world's first percussion ensemble. He also studied with Schoenberg. But his greatest influence seems to have been the music he heard on the streets and in the theaters of San Francisco's Chinatown. Later, he studied in Korea and Taiwan, and he became fascinated by the Balinese ensemble, the gamelan, with its endless percussive repetitions and subtle shifts in rhythm and pitch. You can hear the Oriental influence in both pieces on this new recording, the gentle suite for violin, piano, and small orchestra from 1951, a decade before Harrison visited Asia, and his ambitious piano concerto, commissioned in 1985 by Keith Jarrett and recorded in 1986 at a live concert in Tokyo with Jarrett and the New Japan Philharmonic under Naoto Otomo. The work is Brahmsian in size, and for a few bars even threatens to be Brahmsian in tone. Then suddenly, Harrison thumbs his nose at all of 19th century European concert music and hits us with a soft focus, Jarrett-like version of Madame Butterfly. The riveting second movement, Stampede, is named after a medieval dance form called estampi. You can hear a distinctly Latin, almost a samba beat, something like a 1980s version of Malagueña. The slow movement and the brief finale are prettier. Harrison calls it lace work. Technically, the most fascinating thing about the concerto is that the piano is not given the standard modern tuning, in which, for example, G sharp and A flat are the same note. Harrison says his tuning, based on a theory by the 18th century composer Johann Philipp Kernberger, quote, contains the whole history of Western music from Babylonia to the mid part of the last century. The black keys sound like medieval scales. The white keys more like Renaissance or Baroque intonation. It's an appealingly fresh sound. The selected orchestra consists of instruments that can match the piano's special tuning. Trombones, harps, and such diversely exotic percussion instruments as sleigh bells, maracas, and glockenspiel. A few weeks ago, the Boston Symphony programmed this concerto, its first Harrison. And the conservative BSO audience loved its combination of high energy and delicately tuneful orientalism. I'm not sure the music ever gets as deep as it wants to, but it's an extremely pleasurable piece, a calming addition to the late 20th century repertory.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed works by Lou Harrison on the New World record label. This is Fresh Air. Patrick McGrath grew up in a house on a hill 50 yards from the largest hospital for the criminally insane in England. His father ran the hospital and also saw patients on the grounds. McGrath worked at mental institutions for a while himself, but gave that up to become a writer. What he writes is horror fiction. He says he's interested in how the mind tends to deceive itself. His first collection of short stories is called Blood and Water and Other Tales. When I spoke with him, I asked him to read the opening paragraph from his story, The Angel.
You know the Bowery, I presume. It was on the Bowery that I first caught a glimpse of Harry Tallboys. I was a writer in those days, and I lived in a five-story walk-up by the men's shelter. I didn't realize at the time that Harry Tallboys lived in the same building, though of course I was familiar with the powerful smell of incense that contaminated the lower floors. It was high summer when I met him, high summer in Manhattan, when liquid heat settles on the body of the city like an incubus, and one's whole activity devolves to a languid commerce of flesh and fluids, the ingestion and excretion of the one by the other, and all sane organisms quite simply estivate. I was certainly estivating. I rose late in the day, and after certain minimal ritualistic gestures of the writerly kind, made my way to the liquor store. It was on one of these errands, on a garbage-strewn and urine-pungent sidewalk, beneath a blazing sun and slimed in my own sweat, that I first encountered Harry Tallboys.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that paragraph is because you get the sense of heat and of everything putrefying and oozing, and I think yes. that really is kind of follows throughout your stories.
Yes, I think in horror stories you do get a lot of rot, or in my horror stories there's a lot of rot.
Any reason for that?
I think that all horror stories tend to be obsessed with decay in one form or another. Horror stories prefer to be set in ruins rather than in sound structures. They prefer to deal with the madness of a crumbling mind rather than, with crystal clear sanity. They prefer shadows to daylight. And one particular instance of that sort of decay is in the realm of the biological.
Now, I think your writing has a certain Victorian sensibility to it. even the beginning of the paragraph that you just read, you know the Bowery, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you rooted in that period in some way?
I don't know. I suppose, in the sense that distance always lends enchantment to the view, that there is a sort of charm to old and arcane forms. And in linguistic terms, or in literary terms, I find that those sorts of pre-modern forms of writing are simply very attractive to me. Those rather ponderous and pompous and long sentences full of semicolons and so on. I just delight in them.
Noah, Victorian times leads us to Freud, which I think leads us to your father. Now, your father was the superintendent of the Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum in England. Would you explain what the asylum was?
Well, it's not an asylum as such, because this is, in fact, Victorian terminology, and my father spent most of his career fighting against that particular terminology. It's a mental hospital, and this is the largest maximum security mental hospital in England, and it's where what are now termed the mentally ill offenders are sent. And these are men and women who have, while in a state of psychosis, have committed some particularly fiendish offence that demands that they be in maximum security for the protection of themselves and the protection of the public.
And what was your father's job?
My father administrated the hospital and also had a patient caseload of his own. So essentially, he ran the hospital. My father was eager that we should come to understand mental illness as simply one other form of illness, so that. You know, his own family at least would not suffer from the sort of lurid illusions about insanity that were elsewhere in the society.
Well, that's nice, but look at the kind of imagination you ended up with.
Yes, I know. Something went wrong, didn't it? I tried for a long time to be a socially useful citizen, and it didn't work. It wouldn't take.
In your book, there are two stories in which there are pickled hands and two stories in which there are severed hands that take on lives of their own. Do you have something about hands?
Well, it's not so much that I have something about hands, but that this whole... there is a strain within horror fiction of severed hands. And I was curious as to what it was all about and was reading, actually, a biography of Malcolm Lowry. And in this biography, Lowry is told that being obsessed with severed hands is related to masturbation guilt. And when I read that, I thought, aha. And that's when I wrote a story called Hand of a Wanker, which, explains that this is what severed hands are all about.
Now, there's another severed hand story that I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of. This is from a story called Hand of the Raj. And it's a story about a woman whose fiancé suddenly sprouts a hand growing out of the top of his head.
Yes.
And the hand strangles the man. The woman comes in, finds her husband dead, strangled by this hand. She lies down next to her husband's corpse. Mm. And then would you read from there?
How long she lay there, as the shadows gathered about her and the insects began their shrill and rasping chorus in the dusk, she would never know. But suddenly she became aware that her hair was being very gently stroked. Cecil, she murmured, Cecil, are you still with me? And in a way he was, for the dark hand growing out of his head had begun to softly caress Lucy's hair. And such was the lightness, the delicacy of its touch, that the demented girl did not recoil in horror, but remained sobbing on the corpse as the hand soothed her and calmed her and brought her slowly to a state of passive languor. And when it gently touched her neck, she still did not resist, did not leap back in disgust, but allowed the fingers to melt her pain to pleasure and revive the longings that had first been spawned by the hot sun of Suez. And once again, Lucy Heppelwhite was filmed with perspiration, and she moaned in the shadows of the body of her lover.
What were you thinking about when you wrote that?
I was just thinking, you know, what a gruesomely neat idea this is, that a man could be dead, but part of his body could remain alive, and that his fiance could actually be seduced by this part of his body that still retained life somehow. I thought, this is the most bizarre idea I've ever had, and I was enjoying myself when I wrote that.
Since you're so interested in the gruesome, what do you do when you encounter something gruesome in real life? For instance, say you encounter a dead rat in which a lot of insects are feeding.
Mm.
Are you going to stare at it and really look at it so that you could describe it really accurately in your next story? Or will you avert your eyes and try to forget what you'd seen?
The first. I'll stare at it. I mean, I think it's interesting. Don't you? Wouldn't you?
Well, I'll tell you, I've actually been in this situation a lot lately because there's all these cats that live on my block, and they're constantly bringing me offerings. So, there's always, like, dead birds and mice and stuff outside my house, and part of me is really drawn to it, and part of me is just absolutely horrified, and I don't even want to look at it or deal with it. So, I don't know, I have this kind of compulsive look, don't look.
Yes, I think maybe that's why we like horror fiction, if we like it. It's because we are caught with a sort of fascination and repulsion simultaneously, and the horror writer probably has to exploit that that attraction, and make it stronger so that you can enjoy your own repulsion while completely fulfilling your desire to look.
Patrick McGrath, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Patrick McGrath's collection of short stories, Blood and Water and Other Tales, is published by Poseidon Press. His first novel is due out in May. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Alex Chadwick. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
President-elect Bush has named another important member of his administration. He's picked Brent Scowcroft to be his national security advisor. Mr. Scowcroft is a former Air Force general, and he's had senior positions in prior administrations. He's an interesting man. We'll have a story on what that may mean. South African President P.W. Botha has commuted the death sentences of six black South Africans who were convicted in the mob killing of a black township official. We'll have the story on that. And we'll have a conversation with a Virginia legislator who sponsored a bill to increase the number of women's restrooms as compared to men's.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The last time you looked up a word in the dictionary, did the definition you found make sense? Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says we should redefine our expectations of the dictionary.
I got a call from my friend Judith Wasso, who'd been going over a homework assignment with her ninth-grade daughter, Molly. One of those deals where you have to look up a list of unfamiliar words in the dictionary and use them in a sentence. Molly was clearly having problems. For example, she looked up the word rhetorical, and part of the definition was showy, concerned with style and effect. So she put down the sentence, "The girl had a very rhetorical room." I told Judith that the fault was not with the dictionary that Molly was using. And it wasn't any reflection on Molly's mental capacities. I can personally vouch for the fact that there ain't no flies on Molly Wasso. The real villain in the story is the age-old idea that the best way to learn the meaning of a new word is to look it up in a dictionary the moment you run across it. Hence all those homework assignments involving dictionary skills, which begin in fifth or sixth grade and continue through high school. But a couple of recent studies by Princeton psychologist George Miller and Patricia Gildea suggest that this isn't really a very effective way of learning the meaning of a word. What a dictionary does, after all, is to take all the different uses of a word and pull them out of context, then supply them with a collection of paraphrases that are also taken out of context. And if you don't know the meaning of the word in the first place, this is usually not very helpful. There's an old story about a kid who writes in a composition, "My father came home from work with a cliché on his face." His teacher asks him what he means, and he says, "But I looked up cliché in the dictionary, and it said a worn-out expression." That story's probably apocryphal, but Miller and Gildea found that this kind of misunderstanding was very common. They would ask a kid to look up the word erode and use it in a sentence, and the kid would respond with something like, "Our family erodes a lot." This was puzzling until they realized that the dictionary definition for erode included the phrase "eat out," "eat away." Or they'd find a kid writing, "The cook stimulated the soup," since one of the synonyms given for stimulate is stir up. Overall, in fact, the dictionary plays a very overrated role in vocabulary learning. Even if kids were to look up a new word every single day, that would account for only about 5% of the vocabulary that the average high school student learns in a single year. We pick up most of our new words from reading and listening, glomming their meanings out of the context by a mysterious process that is what really intrigues psychologists about the whole business. Now, I have nothing against encouraging kids to use the dictionary to look up unfamiliar words, as long as it doesn't stop there. But if that were all that dictionaries were good for, there'd be no need for them to define all the familiar words that everybody already knows how to use. Until 200 years ago, in fact, dictionaries listed only what were called hard and unusual words. You could find a definition for fatuous, but none for foolish, stupid, or silly. You'd find tedious, but not dull or boring. But as any lexicographer will tell you, it's the simple words that are hardest to define and the most instructive to think about. That's why the Oxford English Dictionary gave a total of 23 pages to the definition of the single word set. It's a real page-turner for us word nerds, but who else would ever look it up? I guess what I'd really like is for Molly's teacher to give her an assignment that made her grapple with the problem of defining some simple words like silly and foolish, or even nerd and wimp, and then send her to a couple of dictionaries to see how they handled the job. Then she might come to see what most people never realize, that the dictionary is not just a useful reference book, but can sometimes even be a good read.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I speak with veteran jazz singer Chris Connor, who first became known for her work with the Stan Kenton Band. Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker is no Casey Kasem, but tomorrow he unveils the Tucker Top 5. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Scrooged. It's a comic remake of the Dickens classic A Christmas Carol, starring Bill Murray. So I hope you can join us. And drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.